Hello, this is Rita. It's from the Talk and Information Center. It's Friday, January 23rd, the Plymouth Independent. Explosion, fire damage, Heaven Road, home. Six people escape uninjured. The cause is under investigation. By Mark Pothier. A Monday morning explosion fire at 35 Haven Road, Rahome, that displaced six people and caused significant damage and under investigation by local and state officials. Firefighters responding to a 911 call just before 10 a.m. found flames shooting from the second floor of the house, but were able to bring the blaze under control in about 20 minutes, according to the Plymouth Fire Department. All six people inside the home were able to escape before firefighters arrived. The American Red Cross is working with local officials to find them temporary housing. The fire department said in a press release that the location was challenging because the neighborhood off Long Pond Road lacks hydrants, but, it said, firefighters managed to draw enough water from the supplies kept on their engines to quickly douse the heavy flames, preventing the blaze from spreading into the attic of the home. According to the chief, Neil Foley, the first arriving engine recognized what we needed to do and were able to make a transitional attack on the fire, keeping it out of the attic space. He said firefighters did a great job of preventing the fire from getting into the attic and completely engulfing the home. The local fire department and the Massachusetts State Police Fish Fire and Explosion Investigation Unit are investigating what happened. Officials did not provide an estimate of the amount of damage caused by the fire. Select board asked for trim budget to offset rising healthcare costs. Town manager Derek Berinsdiski will present the pared down proposal in advance of a key vote set for Tuesday by Fred Fies. Select board members voted unanimously on Friday to instruct town manager Derek Berinsdiski to come up with a $22.5 million in proposed budget cuts to consider at its Tuesday night meeting. In a unanimous vote on Friday, board members asked for the alternative budget proposal after listening to dire predictions about the town's fiscal future. The move to pen an alternative proposed budget signals growing concern among town officials over the town's ability to raise as much money as it spends next year and whether the taxpayers can sustain deficit spending to keep up. The primary focus of concern centered on the rising costs of healthcare for current and former town employees, according to the discussion at Friday's meeting. We need to think about how we rein in healthcare costs because I don't believe that we can sustain increases for a second straight year like we are sustaining this year, Berinsdiski told the board. The town's healthcare costs are expected to increase by $5.1 million, and unless they are contained, Berinsdiski projected a fiscal crisis in fiscal year 2028. I am forecasting a very bleak outcome 18 months from now, he said. The board is set to vote on one of the proposed budgets. Berinsdiski's $343 million original proposal, or a more frugal budget that assumes 1% less in property tax revenue. At a joint meeting of the Select Board and the Advisory Finance and Committee on meeting on Tuesday. The $343 million budget for fiscal year 2027, which begins July 1st, represents a 5% increase over this year's. After hearing the dire prediction, members of the board asked for the alternative budget to include the cuts. The town pays 70% of total healthcare insurance premiums for employees and various, often more generous, percentages for retirees. Until October, monthly healthcare claims were between $3.5 million and $4 million. Starting in October, they spiked up to about $5 million a month, said Lynn Barrett, the town finance director. Barrett told board members she erred in October when she based the cost of future health care claims on past claims, creating a $1.1 million shortfall since Berinsdiski first presented his proposed budget on December 16th. So we need to go up premiums for health insurance, Barrett said, predicting a 14% increase in the premiums the town pays for employees. In addition, the premiums the town pays for retirees rose by 12 to 13% as of January 1st. One possible hope for town coffers is not some patients. The insurance manager for the town insurance no longer covers some GLP-1 weight loss drugs such as Ozempic and Wegovy, just used to treat obesity. Savings from the loss of coverage could amount to more than $3 million, Barrett said. However, 339 employees and retirees could lose their access to these drugs because Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts has discontinued coverage of GLP-1 drugs for obesity as of January 1st, though it continues to cover them for treatment of type 2 diabetes. Environment and health. Controversial condo development could overlook toxic waste site. The land adjacent to a planned 163-unit North Plymouth complex has long been mired in environmental issues, by Andrea Estes. It's a beautiful location offering sweeping harbour views, but Pulte's Homes' proposed six-storey condo building on Sandry Drive also overlooks a most empty expanse of weeds and trees once declared a toxic waste site by federal environmental authorities. It is a Plymouth Harbour Canyon Engineering Group Environmental Protection Agency Superfund site where officials found lead, fuel, oil, and other hazardous substances leaking from above-ground storage tanks in 1980. Though the site was cleaned and removed from the Environmental Protection Agency's national priority list in 1993, it still is subject to five-year reviews. In addition, there is a continuing deep restriction on the property prohibiting construction of housing on the site. It also cannot be used for recreation. The revelations about the ongoing environmental concerns near the already controversial 163-unit condominium complex could give its neighbours and opponents another foothold in their long battle to stop it. The Superfund site sits beside the largest of three buildings proposed for the condominium complex. Select Board member Deb Equinto, a vocal critic of the project, called news of the adjacent Superfund site one more shocking revelation. The question is to know what, when and how this project can continue to move forward without the developer and property owner fully and publicly addressing these issues, serious issues, she said. I think we should hit the pause button on any decisions regarding this development until we have full transparency and accountability, Equinto added. Representatives of Pulte Homes of New England and the well-known Sheehan family, which owns the land set to be developed, did not return phone calls seeking comment. In their most recent five-year report issued in 2023, EPA officials said there's no evidence contamination has spread to other property, but cautioned against future guarantees. The risk posed by the climate change in New England could possibly impact the protectiveness of the remedy at the site in the future, the report said. The impacts of sea level rise, flooding and on or storm surge could possibly adversely affect the clean soil cover because the site is located near Plymouth Harbour, the report continued. Sea level rise could cause groundwater to rise. If the groundwater is contaminated, that could be an issue. At the now overgrown property, broken down fencing has enabled homeless people to erect tents and live there, the report says. The land is owned by the New Millennium Ventures, a company associated with Joseph Janetti, who developed Cordage Park, the business and industrial area next to the Plymouth Harbour. Cordage Park property manager Kristen Ligori said, whilst there is a possibility of reusing or redeveloping the site on Sandry Drive in the future, there are no plans currently. The EPA determined that an industrial commercial business could operate on the site. Beyond the questions raised by the proximity to the Superfund site, there are potential environmental issues within the Pulte site itself, a former warehouse for L. Knife and Sons, the Sheehan family business. This fall, environmental consultants found arsenic and other harmful chemicals in the soil and water at L. Knife Sandry Drive location. The arsenic was present in a sufficient quantity to require removal, as ordered in an October 1 urgent legal letter from the State Department of Environmental Protection to the property owners. DEP documents show Eight Mates LLC had 7,500 gallons of water containing arsenic removed from the site and 200 tons of arsenic removed from the soil. Long-term exposure to arsenic can pose serious health risks and is a known human carcinogen. So far, neither Pulte nor the Sheehan family has publicly disclosed these concerns. The purchase and sale agreement signed in November 2023 between Pulte and the two Sheehan family companies, L. Knife and Sons and Eight Mates LLC, doesn't mention any environmental concerns or its proximity to the Superfund site. Instead, the agreement declaratively states there has been no discharge, spillage, controlled loss, seepage or filtration of hazardous waste on, under or within the property or any contiguous real estate. A new draft amended purchase and sale agreement obtained by the Independent acknowledges arsenic was found on the Sandry Drive site as well as a different piece of the project on Hedge Road. Buyer has identified on the portion of the property located at O. Sandry Drive a historical release of arsenic in soil and groundwater at levels that require further action under environmental law, the draft agreement says. Buyer has identified on the portion of the other property located at 39 Hedge Road elevated concentrations of arsenic in a soil stockpile. Buyer also identified other potential environmental concerns at the property, the draft amendment says. The news P&S requires Eight Mates to dispose of the contaminated materials. With all the critiques of the Pulte proposal, it's out of character with the neighbourhood. It will create too much traffic and not enough parking. Major environmental concerns have yet to emerge. But environmental experts, including the former head of the Superfund program, said they would be comfortable living nearby as long as they were sure a thorough clean-up had been completed. By all the reports I read, the remedy for the Cannon site was successfully implemented, the focus being an soil remediation and placing clean fill over the contaminated soils, said Jim Wolford, the former longtime director of the EPA Superfund program. That location, though, does raise a future concern with sea level rise from global warming, he added. The question is whether the site is or could be subject to flooding, say from a strong northeaster or a hurricane. In that case, could the cover over the contaminated soil left in place erode to the point that the contaminated soils become suspended and could migrate, he said. He pointed out that fencing around the property had fallen into disrepair, even though EPA officials said the fencing may no longer be needed. This fencing is an important aspect of the remedy to keep individuals off the site so they can't compromise the remedy or cause themselves exposure, Woodford said. As for the Pulte itself, Lenny Siegel, who heads the California-based Center for Public Environmental Oversight, said after reviewing various DEP reports, there is no reason to believe it is unsafe to build at the site due to the current levels of contamination. But I think the potential risk due to anticipated sea level rise should be evaluated. It's easier to protect against much risk when building a project than later when people are already living there, he said. The 2.5-acre Plymouth Harbour Canyon Engineering Corp site contained three above-ground storage tanks holding lead and how low levels of dangerous chemicals called polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs. According to EPA documents, the tanks were all sat between 50 feet and 180 feet from the Plymouth Harbour, were originally constructed in the 1920s and used for storing fuel and oil unloaded from barges. In 1975, the company started storing motor oils, industrial oils, and other hazardous substances in the tanks, the document says. The company transported and stored hazardous waste at the Plymouth facility and incinerated it at its Bridgewater, Massachusetts facility until 1980, when the facilities went into receivership, according to the EPA. The site was placed on the National Priorities List in September 1983. After cleanup, EPA took the site off the list in November 1993. Over the years, the Sheehan family has offered various proposals for redeveloping their North Plymouth properties. In 2017, Sheehan floated the idea of building a school in the neighborhood with student housing and a community center, according to news reports at the time. Even earlier in the late 1980s and early 1990s, Eight Mates LLC proposed an apartment complex for the land between Prince S and Hedge Road. It would have not been a 40B affordable housing project. Called The Village at Hedge Road, the plan consisted of 74 one- and two-bedroom apartments in 34 detached buildings with a traditional design featuring cedar shingles and peaked roofs. The company obtained permits from the zoning boards of appeals and other town committees. The approvals were extended multiple times, but the project never moved forward. Town documents don't say why. I think the neighborhood would prefer the site remained undeveloped, said Select Board member Kevin Canty, a North Plymouth resident. However, past proposals were more in line with the character of the area and fit better into the fabric of North Plymouth. They would have been more palatable to the neighborhood and its residents. I think anything would be better than the mega project built by an out-of-town developer who clearly couldn't care less about the concerns of the people living nearby, Canty said. Cure for the Winter Blues, a cozy historic home with 8 fireplaces. But this Bishop Harlow house tell also unearths a dubious period of redevelopment in Plymouth by Bill Fornaciari. As much as I love Plymouth, I don't appreciate the extended time from shortly after the New Year starts until about St. Patrick's Day. Just the other day, it was so dark and grey mid-morning that the outside Christmas lights, which I haven't taken down, turned on. Ugh. It's not so much the cold I despise as the cold partnered with the short, bleak days common this time of year. The only place I really enjoy in midwinter is a home, ideally, when I get around to it, with a fire going in the fireplace. I love a home fire so much that a few years ago, I seriously thought of moving to a house with a fireplace in every room in hopes that I would cure my winter blues. The house in question was a Bishop Harlow house at 22 Summer Street, which hit the real estate market in the spring of 2018 with the listing price of $440,000. It has long been a favorite of mine. Built sometime after 1789, it is a classic federal period home featuring a pedimented entry door, symmetrical front facade, brick ends, and 8 fireplaces. Yes, it was 8 fireplaces. That was the big draw for me. The floor plan featured a classic four-room plan on the first floor, replicated on the second floor, and joined by a central staircase hall. Each room has a fireplace, with the kitchen boasting a bake oven. Even more appealing was a modern, unobstructed basement with full-sized doors and windows at the rear of the house, opening into the patio overlooking Town Brook. It looked like a perfect space for my architectural practice to occupy, shortening my commute from 10 minutes to 1. The basement clearly was not from the original building, which in 1966 was moved diagonally across the street from its old location to save the historic house from the wrecking ball that was moving fast through the neighborhood. Urban renewal was then in vogue, and Plymouth was one of the first towns in New England to apply the forces of mid-20th century progress. Readers have long asked me to write about what happened almost 60 years ago that can change a significant portion of our downtown. Truth be told, I have been hesitant because for so many Plymouth residents, the land clearing and the subsequent redevelopment remains a raw and open wound. The Plymouth Development Authority was established in 1958 by an act of the selectmen. The authority was given the responsibility to apply federal urban renewal funds to improve and clear blighted neighborhoods. The target area was 30-acre parcel that included Summer, High, Spring, Market, and Russell Streets. In today's world, it's the area that the home to the John Carver Inn, the Spring Hill apartment blocks, and the parking lot that is between Main Street Extension and Market Street. It is also included the area around the La Bamba restaurant. At the time, the neighborhood was filled with textbook examples of Georgian and federal architecture, as well as multiple properties constructed in the 1600s. Spring Street contained a row of small Cape Cod-style buildings that may well have been the oldest standing structures in America. Granted, some of these properties lacked heat, running water, and sanitation, but a good majority of them were in great shape, including one that had been refurbished by an uncle of mine. On a side note, the Summer High Street project was a case study in historic preservation class during my college years. The professor noted that Plymouth and Boston's West End were the only locations in Massachusetts that received federal money for urban renewal. When the Plymouth site was cleared, officials from Salem, Portsmouth, Newport, and Newburyport visited, and subsequently, the professor told us, no New England city sought money for urban renewal. I'm not sure how true that story was, but the fact that those cities have managed to maintain large swaths of their historic downtown cores suggests the professor wasn't far off. For those interested in learning about the redevelopment process, I highly recommend Beyond Plymouth Rock, America's Hometown in the 20th Century, Volume 2, edited by John Chaffee and Karen Goldsteins, From Pilgrims to Poverty, both available at the public library. They detail the story in depth from the residents' point of view, as well as the redevelopment authority's stance. Returning to my story, the homes targeted and scheduled for removal were appraised and an offer was made to the owners. David Kalapowitz, who owned the Bishop Harlow House, refused. Further complicated matters, the federal grant money did not provide an avenue to restore or move properties deemed worthy of restoration. It was 1965, and by chance, a summer resident overheard a protest of the removal of an elm tree in the project boundaries. Under investigation, she learned about the plight of the Bishop Harlow House. Mrs. Eric Wentworth, better known as Muffy, was a summer resident of Mantis Point and was very well connected politically. Springing into action, she requested a 2-week reprieve for the house to raise funds. Wentworth reached out to her friend, Senator Edward Kennedy, who in a remarkably short time was able to rewrite legislation to support moving historic properties within urban renewal sites, with funding established for moving the house. Wentworth helped start the Pilgrim Heritage Trust and quickly raised $30,000 needed for restoration. The building found a home across the street on the site of former 18th century building that had already been demolished. The irony of that is comical. For all the machinations, the home still belonged to Kapowitz, through negotiations, he finally agreed to sell Price of $13,500, an offer he considered a settlement, not a concession, that all the property is worth. On November 9, 1966, the Redevelopment Authority sold the building for $1 to the trust. After restorations, the trust leased the upper floor apartment to a family while the lower level was rented with the Plymouth County Visitor Nurses Association. The Nurses Association eventually owned the entire property, but sometime in the 1990s, the building was sold and returned to single-family use. In 2018, I entered the picture, hoping to add my own page to the history of the British Bishop Harlow home. My husband and I visited the house 3 times. Our last visit, expecting to soon complete the signing and purchase, was on a warm midsummer day. All the windows were open, and we gathered in the front parlour to discuss our final offer and contingencies. Our conversation was interrupted when a pack of motorcycles roared by. The house shook and we couldn't even hear each other over the din. Ben looked at me and said, "Nope." That ended my dream of owning a classic federal home with 8 fireplaces. The house is still there and is even available on Vrbo, V-R-B-O. I suffer through winter with 1 fireplace and I still have an arduous 10-minute commute. Sometimes I get through the winter by dreaming of an architectural project that would replicate the old Summer Street neighborhoods. If they had survived, I imagine the area would be one of the most desirable places to live in Plymouth, even with motorcycle noise. This concludes the Plymouth Independent, Friday, January the 23rd. This is Rita from the Talking Information Center. Thank you and have a good day.